Hi, welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson, here with my co-host Celia Farber. Today we have a very important guest for moving the ball forward on the Epstein pedophile blackmail ring story. Melissa Cronin was part of a team of investigative entertainment reporters looking into Epstein's activities that resulted in a fascinating book titled Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, Spies, Lies, and Blackmail. For one thing, they've uncovered tantalizing new details about the connection between Epstein's blackmail operation and various intelligence agencies. Melissa also currently executive produces at Broad and Water Studios, including for the podcast Epstein, Devil in the Darkness. So she's in an ongoing investigative situation with this story. As managing editor of content for American Media, Melissa regularly broke website traffic records, delivering major exclusives across multiple platforms, including Radar Online, Star Magazine, OK Magazine. She led reporters to quickly disseminate stories on Cosby's trial over alleged sex crimes, Bobby Christina Brown's wrongful death trial, Prince's death, Kanye West's 9/11 call, and many more. Melissa is clearly a powerhouse among entertainment reporters who are also investigative reporters. To those who stand on their high horses and poo-poo entertainment reporting, I'll say this. Entertainment reporters like Melissa are not as deferential and afraid of powerful people as other reporters. They understand how people in that arena behave and think, and very often they're way ahead of other media on stories like this one. I think they're especially important these days, particularly to this sex trafficking stories, because as I said, they understand the personalities and perversions of powerful people better than most reporters. So they have better ideas about where to look and what to ask. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, I truly appreciate the work that you guys did on this. And, you know, I think this little blurb at the cover of the book is where I want to start, and then we'll back out into other details that you guys uncovered. This is what really caught my eye, because not very many people are looking hard into this. You wrote, it's written on this, the conclusion is clear. Epstein was a spy running a complex intelligence operation for the purpose of blackmailing powerful individuals and politicians in the United States and abroad. But for whom? So could you just start talking about how you guys ran into this, what characters you ran into and what they said, and how you put this, how you put, you know, two and two and two and six and five and whatever together to come to this conclusion?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you started there, because that is really what people need to understand about this man in this case. So Dylan and James, my co-authors, and I have been reporting on Epstein since back in 2014, when the first civil cases were coming out in Florida. So as you said, I was an entertainment reporter at the time. We were covering dozens of different stories every day. But when the court documents came out from this Epstein case in Florida, all of us, you know, were just blown away by the horrifying details in there. And additionally, by the fact that it seemed like no one in the mainstream media was even covering this. We followed that case incredibly closely, doing multiple stories a day on the different developments and what Virginia Roberts Giuffre was saying in that case. This was the first time that we heard allegations about Prince Andrew. We published her handwritten diary at the time. We published the flight logs that show Bill Clinton had flown with her 27 times. And this was all in the run-up to the 2016 election. So it was incredibly relevant. Both of the major candidates for the various parties had been implicated in the story. But nobody seemed to care. Nobody was listening to it. You know, it kind of, you know, people at that time, especially, I think, just couldn't confront the enormity of the horror that was Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh, and I think they're afraid of dealing with the powerful. I've seen this over and over, you know, they're afraid of the powerful. Yeah.
And it's almost too much for people to digest because so many of the systems that they take for granted as being protective and essential to the underpinning of our democracy are not that at all. You know, they're actively working against the very people that they're supposed to be protecting.
Bingo.
So, yeah. So a lot changed in the last couple of years culturally in terms of the Me Too movement. And when Julie Brown's Miami Herald reporting kind of cracked open the case again and he was arrested, we all said to each other, we have to get back into this again. We have to chase down all the leads that we ever had and talk to everyone that had ever sent us a tip and really just throw all our resources at it once and for all to find out what happened. And very quickly, we realized that the story was not about this, you know, scandalous, titillating pedophilia sex ring. Sure, that's what we've covered since 2014. The real story here is the story underneath. It's about the systems that enabled him and allowed him to continue doing this for decades at a time with the support of various governments and intelligence agencies. So as we were exploring that, we went directly to the places where Epstein had been operating. We went to, for the first time, his New Mexico ranch, the Zorro Ranch. And that was some place I had always wanted to really send a reporter because everyone knows about Palm Beach. Everyone knows about New York. Everyone knows about the Caribbean island, but the ranch had never really been cracked open. So we sent one of our best reporters out there, and she really hit pay dirt in terms of understanding what was going on. She found a woman never before identified who was actually kind of the scheduler for the Zorro Ranch, by which I mean she was charged with bringing in young women to the ranch so that they would serve on and entertain the guests, who included Prince Andrew, who included Nobel Prize physicists. And this woman...
And the Clintons, too, right?
...listened to the conversations that we're having there. I'm sorry?
Didn't the Clintons visit, too? Zorro Ranch?
We didn't find that they visited the ranch.
Oh, but weren't they in some housing or something? Like, Zorro Ranch had this guest housing or something that was off the compound or something, as I recall?
Yes. So we found that Prince Andrew definitely stayed in the lodge. The woman did not have any confirming evidence about the Clintons at the ranch.
Okay. I'm thinking of something else.
Unfortunately, they didn't, you know, keep a guest book, but it certainly could be implied. So this woman explained to us how Ghislaine had told her that the purpose of bringing these people to the ranch was to get information from them. She said, Ghislaine said, we just get the information and then get rid of them. And she talked about witnessing these dinner parties where Ghislaine, Epstein's right-hand woman, would sit there taking copious notes about what these physicists and scientists and tech gurus were talking about. That was kind of our first inkling about, you know, another operation beyond just the honey trap. And we learned more about that information gathering, that kind of relationship trading that Epstein had been involved with since the 1980s, when we got connected with one of his former colleagues in New York, a man named Stephen Hoffenberg. Hoffenberg had worked with Epstein at Towers Financial. They operated a Ponzi scheme there. And he told us how he eyewitnessed meetings with Epstein and foreign agents, how Epstein was involved in money laundering deals and had really close relationships with leaders of Middle Eastern nations. So over time, as we spoke to more and more people, it became clear that he was gathering this scientific information from people like Bill Gates, from Stephen Hawking, and then using that information to deliver it to various foreign agencies. So we found that he had been handled initially by the Mossad, but he did develop relationships with Saudi Arabia later on and essentially just traded information to kind of the highest bidder. So to me, that's the most fascinating and important to understand pieces of this story, because people, when they think of spies, they do think of, oh, the honey trap, or, you know, bugging a room and putting a camera in a clock. Sure, he was doing that. But modern espionage is about information, getting information that people can use to make armaments or to make surveillance apps, which we found that Epstein did. And this is the kind of thing that is going to continue even after his death. And it's important to understand, because the situation was not about one evil man that's now been, you know, snuffed out. This is a system that can continue to operate with other players for all time if we don't confront it.
So, okay, so you're talking about this spying stuff. So why don't we get into a little more detail? Could you talk about Ehud Barak, you know, explain to our audience who Ehud Barak is, and about Rapporti, now Carbine Company, as part of
yes.
that, correct?
Mm-hmm. This is one of the most chilling parts of the book, and it's the last chapter. We really want to leave people with that thought. So Ehud Barak is former Israeli prime minister, and he was photographed and videotaped visiting Jeffrey Epstein's New York City home with young women also entering and exiting the property. And he has always said that his relationship with Epstein, you know, like that of an acquaintance. But we found some information and documentation about a business venture that the two men were involved in together. So this is a company called Carbine. They developed an app that is now known as Smart 911. And the people involved in this app, even just to start out, should kind of give a red flag to anyone looking at it. Everyone on the board of this company involved in developing this app, including Ehud Barak, is either a former Israeli intelligence officer or Israeli military official. And then there's Jeffrey Epstein, who supplied millions of dollars to the funding of this application. It's also worth noting that a kind of peripheral figure in the development of the app was Michael Cohen, President Trump's fixer, now in prison. Cohen was receiving a massive consulting fee from a company that also was involved in investing in this app. So the app, now known as Smart 911, has been rolled out to governments in 40 United States at this time.
Wow.
The app, it purports to be something of a, you know, municipal app, something that's going to help cities operate more efficiently. Essentially, it allows someone, if you download it on your phone, when you dial 911, it immediately sends a live video feed and your coordinates to the 911 dispatcher in your town, which sounds like it might be helpful if you ever need to call 911. But, you know, as with so many apps, the dark side of this is really chilling, because the reality is this app allows the people behind the technology to access a live feed of your camera at any time, to access all the information stored on your phone, health records, photographs, GPS coordinates. And this technology has been placed on the phones of citizens all across the country without really a second look.
Oh my God.
And the people behind it receiving the information have, you know, unending ties to Israeli intelligence and the Israeli military. And, you know, coming just a few weeks off the news that there was an Israeli surveillance device discovered very close proximity to the White House, it's worth looking at the fact that they're kind of seeding the nation with this app, with the potential to spy on citizens across the country.
Jesus.
Good grief. Okay. We don't have this app on our phone, I hope.
No, I know. Everyone who's listening should check.
Yeah.
So it would be something that very easy to download. Hi, Melissa. This is Celia. And really great to have you on.
Thanks.
Wow. So it's like, it's a, shall I say, mainstream app?
So It's rolled out by city government. So my understanding is that the city government has to kind of buy in. And what I've seen is the city governments are actually the ones that promote it, which is just, you know, genius if you're a foreign intelligence agency, because you're seeing press releases from like City Hall and, you know, Dubuque or whatever, saying, hey, everyone, this is such a great technology. And they promote this story of a guy who just happened to have the app on his phone and it saved his life, you know, years before it was ever introduced in the United States. So it's just,
I would, if I heard about that and didn't know, I would get it immediately. Everybody would.
Right?
It's
brilliant. It's so brilliant. But when I first found it, I thought it had only been rolled out in like one or two states. And then the more that we looked into it, I saw it was.
So, I think
we did, about this.
Hold up. I think we lost you for a minute. Could you repeat that, please?
Hello?
Yeah. Could you repeat what you just said? Because I think we lost you for a minute. Your sound dropped out.
Sorry about that. I was saying when we first started looking into the app, most of the documentation and reporting was from the early days of its release. So I thought it had only been rolled out in one or two cities in America. But as we continued to dig into it, and I realized it was actually in 40 states and growing, that was just absolutely mind-blowing to me and chilling to me, because, you know, it's almost too late. It's already been spread across the country and is operating across the country.
You know, I want to go back to this Hoffenberg character, because I find it so interesting that he and Epstein were running this Ponzi scheme, and these two lawyers, Darren Indyk and Richard Kahn, were supposed to be looking into this, the Ponzi scheme, right, for Tower Financial. And the upshot is, Hoffenberg, they were looking at Epstein's misdeeds at Towers Financial in the 90s. The upshot is Hoffenberg is sentenced to 20 years, a $1 million fine, and $463 million in restitution. And Epstein gets off scot-free, and now Indyk and Kahn are executors of his estate. So, so Hoffenberg, who's obviously unhappy, has been talking about Epstein working in Europe and being involved in money laundering with Adnan Khashoggi. Could you talk about that part, too? Because I was just like, I can't believe the scale of this guy's machinations beyond the horrific blackmail pedophile operation.
It is so true that there's so much even just around Epstein's relationship and business deals with Hoffenberg. We are actually going to be digging into that even more for another upcoming project. But Hoffenberg essentially told us that when he first met Epstein, Epstein was totally broke. So he had been kicked out of Bear Stearns, banned from doing securities trading, was kind of like grasping at straws, finding a way to make some money. And Hoffenberg says that Epstein quickly got kind of folded into the world of, you know, black market deals. So doing armament deals in the Middle East, doing money laundering. He said the armament deals weren't even just like guns in a box. They were using like military aircraft and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that was just one piece of it. But, you know, Epstein,
I'm sorry, your sound dropped off. I'm
as
sorry.
Got, oh, sorry.
Your sound sorry. Dropped off. Epstein, what? What did you say after that?
He's always looking for the next step up. So he's doing these armament deals, fine. When he gets hooked up with Hoffenberg, it's another opportunity. So together, they created the Ponzi scheme in New York that netted them about $600 million. And when it was exposed, like you said, there were two attorneys kind of put a case to, and Hoffenberg claims that Indyk and Khan already knew Epstein at the time, so they had a conflict of interest from the start, according to Hoffenberg. He went to prison, Epstein left, scot-free, like he said. But the key is, Hoffenberg claims Epstein got to keep the money from the Ponzi scheme.
Oh, my God.
If you look into...
The sound is dropping out again. What did you say? If you look into... If you look into what?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I lost you. If you look into... And then I lost you.
Yes. If you look into the court documents surrounding the case, you'll see that the victims, for years later, fought to get restitution alongside Hoffenberg once he got out of prison. But none of them ever got paid back, and Hoffenberg says that's how Epstein kind of seeded his fortune with the money from these victims that essentially, according to Hoffenberg, Indyk and Khan kind of rubber-stamped and allowed to happen. And
well, then, do you think there was a kickback there for Indyk and Khan?
I mean, like you said, they're now executors of a $600 million estate. So I don't know. That's kind of a good pot at the end of the rainbow there for them.
I just want to jump in, if I may, and say I have a very well-connected friend. No, I wouldn't say connected to power, but very well connected to real information. And mm-hmm. He told me many months ago, he said, the whole Epstein thing is weapons and drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real story, that it's weapons for drugs. And that's why, hence all the pilots, airplanes, that they're all flying these planes and all that, and that's like the untold story. Does that sound roughly right? Not that the other isn't also important, but that's almost mm-hmm. like the surface, and this is what's beneath it, and this is the real money.
From what we've heard, that was kind of the start of his ascent. I found any evidence that it continued living, probably because as his fortune grew and as his connections grew, he had more of ways of getting money, whether ownership of Les Wexner, trading the information, investing in businesses with Ehud Barak and things like that. But certainly, his career, and we get into it in the book, he was basically partners with Adnan Khashoggi and connected to all sorts of entities in the Middle East that have been certainly exposed as enabling money laundering, enabling massive drug trade, enabling arms trade. That's
yeah, so my friend had to have been essentially correct, I would say. That sounds
of
right.
Of course, yeah. There were,
and that hasn't come out in the media,
company
would you agree?
In London. No, yeah. And part of it is because the company that he operated through still exists, and the person in it is kind of a... I don't want to get sued yet. We're still working on kind of nailing down the specifics of that business arrangement, because Epstein, according to Hoffenberg, was hired by this company in London to kind of begin that work, and he kind of grew and went off on his own. But there is a money trail in terms of where it all began with the armament and the trading.
Now Khashoggi's dead, so did he have a right hand man or woman that who could be reached? You know, who could be reached to be, you know, issued a subpoena or anything like that? Has anybody even tried to do that or looked into that? Has the FBI been looking into that? Do you know?
I think, like with so many of the people involved with this, it's kind of a dead end that's been allowed to fizzle out a little bit. But we're not giving up on it.
Good.
We just spoke to someone like earlier this week, a journalist in Spain, who told us that one of the shows has been moored off of Marbella.
Wait, I'm sorry. The sound dropped out again. This is very important.
Hello?
What did you say? Your sound dropped off again. What did you say? That a Spanish journalist said what?
The Spanish journalist said that since Epstein's death, there's been a yacht belonging to Khashoggi that's been moored off of Marbella, Spain. And we're kind of working with this journalist to potentially approach the yacht and see who's on it and see, you know, maybe it's just a friend of the family or something like that. But even though Khashoggi's dead, there's certainly the possibility that he is in other ways supporting Epstein's co-conspirators, perhaps even Ghislaine Maxwell.
So Ghislaine also, of course, her father was very connected to Mossad. He died in a strange way. Ghislaine, I think, as his favorite daughter, you know, she probably, you know, is part of the fam. I don't know. You tell me. What are, does she have connections to Israeli intelligence? And what, you know, what did she have any connections to any of these non-sexual pedophile ring activities?
Absolutely. She certainly inherited the family business, so to speak, when it comes to espionage. We found a man now living in Montreal who claims that he was actually the Mossad handler for Robert Maxwell.
Oh.
And Maxwell's now dead, so the British intelligence files about him have been released, and there is information in those files that suggests the British government knew he was Mossad. So this man, Ari Ben Menash, says that he handled and kind of trained Robert, and then as Ghislaine was kind of coming up in the ranks, he was tasked with bringing her into the fold as well. According to Ben Menash, Ghislaine was dating Epstein at the time, and Robert Maxwell kind of tasked him with bringing Epstein too. So he claims that that's how Epstein and Ghislaine both got brought into the espionage business.
So where is Ghislaine right now, and what do you think her prospects are?
We're certainly trying to find her. Personally, we have a source close to the family who says that she's under the protection of the British government, that they are so anxious to tamp down the Prince Andrew thing that they're, you know, essentially giving her cover somewhere within the country.
Whoa, that's interesting.
If you could just walk us through, let's say somebody who just is very naive about this world, let's start with Prince Andrew. What would be the motivation for targeting him specifically and getting, you know, dirty information on him? Like, how does it work if you carry it all the way out from the beginning of, let's say, Epstein and Ghislaine's, you know, sick minds? What's the plot? Like, do you understand what I'm saying? How does it formula?
So Andrew was certainly an easy target for Epstein and Ghislaine because he was already known as, you know, Randy Andy or Handy Andy, even before he became friends with Epstein. So when they got connected, they brought him into their world of salacious parties and things like that. But what's also important to note is Andrew himself has said that he really valued the business introductions that Epstein could give him, because at the time, Andrew's quote unquote job was to be kind of the business ambassador for Great Britain. So his mom told him to go make some friends in the business community, and Epstein was kind of helping with that.
Yeah, because he was only getting £250,000 for his for being a prince, right?
Yeah,
that's not enough to. That's not a princely sum, and he had a family to look after and an ex-wife who needed paying off from time to time, whose debts needed paying off, which Epstein did pay off part of her debts, right?
Yeah, that was just another way that they integrated themselves kind of into that family, and you know. Just to remind everyone, like we said in the book, Epstein and Ghislaine, they made it through the palace gates, literally. They were guests of honor at the Queen's country home. They were guests of honor at Andrew's daughter's birthday party. And just, they got as close to the Queen and Prince Philip almost as possible, you know, beyond just being like best friends with the Queen herself.
Wow.
So the value of that friendship, you know, he was a great target because the British monarchy historically is kind of known for going above and beyond to maintain the status quo and to maintain kind of the royal image of the family. And there's so much there in terms of what happened with Princess Diana and, you know, however they were involved in that situation in terms of trying to protect the family's image. But I think more so than like a businessman or a politician, a royal would be somebody that would do almost anything to protect their image because their image is all that they have.
Exactly.
So blackmailing him could, you know, he had the connections to the business world and politically. And, you know, he and his mother would do just about anything to make themselves look good at the end of the day. So I think that's the reason why he was probably Epstein and Ghislaine's prime target and most valued target throughout the years until, you know, they cut off relationship.
Yeah, he was definitely the highest target. You know, I just want to pivot a little bit to the, because this is also fascinating to me, to the law enforcement part of it. First of all, you know, the FBI, they're gathering, as you put it, from his island there, just, you know, bags and bags and bags. You guys went over there and looked through the window and saw bags and bags of yellow, or these orange evidence bags full of evidence, right? And I was very interested to note that you said that they have yet to raid Zorro Ranch, right?
Right. And that's true even after printing. So we just went back up there last week. And
maybe you guys should raid Zorro Ranch.
I know. Some people have. If you look on YouTube, there's some people that have snuck in, but you know, we try to stay on the line of legal behavior.
No, I endorse that. I think that's good. Yeah. So.
But you know what? We've actually, in our latest trip out there, found that the home is being prepared for sale. So depending on who buys it, we might be able to do some excavating and further investigation of the property.
So I want to talk about, I mean, clearly I have, And I want you to talk about this, too, after we've talked about this other thing. I'm very suspicious of how the FBI is going to handle all this. I'm very suspicious, and maybe we can talk about that. But first, I would like to talk about John Dugan.
Yes.
I think he's very, very important. So if you could explain to the audience who he is and what happened and where he is now, I think that would be very helpful.
Absolutely. This is a fascinating character. So John Mark Dugan was the sheriff's deputy in Palm Beach, Florida at the time of Epstein's first investigation and prison stint there.
Oh, wait, the sound has dropped out completely.
Between
your sound dropped out completely. So you said he was at the
point. So sorry about this, Melissa.
No worries. I'm sorry too. I can never depend on technology, I guess, but we'll make it through. So John Mark Dugan was a sheriff's deputy for Palm Beach County during the time that Epstein was being investigated and put into prison there. So between 2005, 2010. Epstein was investigated by the Palm Beach police, and that investigation was spearheaded by a man named Joseph Ricari. When Epstein went into prison, the case was kind of handed over to the sheriffs because the county was responsible for the prison stint, for making sure that he fulfilled his term for, you know, as we found out, allowing him to go to quote unquote work every day and leave the prison. But the case was handed over from the police to the sheriffs. So Dugan, as the deputy sheriff, says that Detective Ricari of the police force essentially gave him the case files when the case was transferred over. So Ricari basically said, hey, you're in charge of this case now. Here's everything I know. Here's what you need to know about this guy. Gave him the case files, which included the materials that they had taken from his Palm Beach home during the raid. And that included dozens of DVDs of video and audio material, which Dugan says showed older men older men in sexual situations with young women. So these are the original Epstein blackmail tapes. Dugan says they were given to him by Ricari as part of the transfer of the case. So nothing much really happens out of the ordinary as Epstein's fulfilling his term. He gets out of prison. But Dugan starts to notice strange things in the police department, in the sheriff's department. He starts to question, why did this guy get such a sweetheart deal? Why is he allowed to leave prison? Why do his guards call him the client and let him, you know, have female guests when he's out of prison? Dugan essentially, he starts writing about the happenings of the department on the internet. So he starts posting blog posts about the different kinds of corruption that he says he sees within the department, and not just even related to Epstein. He's accusing members of the department of being involved in sexual crimes themselves, of harassment against female officers. He starts to become kind of a vigilante for exposing the corruption in the Palm Beach Police Force and the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department. So he still has these documents. He keeps them at his home, the blackmail files. And Dugan's home is actually raided by the FBI. And after that happened, he's so shaken up. Clearly, this was like an out-of-scale response to someone posting blog posts on the internet. So he takes the blackmail files, flees to Russia, leaving behind his wife and children in Florida, and takes political asylum in Moscow. So he is now living there several years later. I believe it's 6 years since he left Florida. And he says he still has those blackmail files and as he's living in Russia. And he claims that he's now being pursued by the MI6 because of their fears that these documents have proof of Prince Andrew's activities. So Dugan, he's really just started talking about this as the Epstein case has opened up again. And understandably, he says he fears for his life if he were to release these documents. He claims that he's never even looked at them, which, you know, might be posturing just to protect himself.
Well, didn't he have a journalist go over there and yes. Ron Chepesiuk or something? Could mm-hmm. you talk about that?
Yes. So he had like an old friend from Florida who's also a journalist, Ron Chepesiuk, come visit him, and he allowed him to view part of the files just to ostensibly confirm that they existed. And we spoke to Chepesiuk, and he confirmed that he had viewed them, that he had seen what appeared to be a surveillance video of a bedroom showing an older man in sexual acts with a younger woman. Now, Chepesiuk was not able to identify that man, and Dugan himself has not positively identified anyone who's on those tapes. Chepesiuk only viewed a few minutes of the tapes, but he said from what he saw, it seemed like proof that what Dugan's been talking about is true. And we've actually been, you know, in touch with Dugan directly from Moscow. We've been talking to Chepesiuk also, and part of our ongoing investigation is an attempt to actually get over there and hopefully see the tapes for ourselves. Because, you know, as people that have covered this case for almost 10 years, I'm confident that we could identify almost anyone on the grainy tape.
Right, right. Now the FBI wow. has actually pursued him quite aggressively, right? I mean, they they sent 10 agents and federal marshals to a company that he does contract work for, right?
Right.
And then they've tried to arrest him twice through Interpol, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And what about his family? I mean, Joseph Ricari, the police officer with the original access to those blackmail files who gave him that, he died, right?
Right. And yeah, Dugan is 100%.
Go ahead.
Sorry?
No, go ahead.
Dugan's 100% sure that Ricari did not die under natural circumstances. So Ricari was a man completely fit, vibrant in his 60s, and he died suddenly of a very fast acting cancer. So all of the symptoms of what happened to him in the weeks leading up to his death are consistent also with heavy metal poisoning, which obviously is kind of a trademark of KGB assassinations.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's not the only one that's died that way in Florida. So
who else?
There's, I'm sure you saw in the book, there's several other people that died in very close proximity to Ricari who were crucial to the case, like Epstein's gardener and gateman, Alfredo Rodriguez. He died under almost the same circumstances, very young, very fast death, very unexpected. So there's a trail there. And understandably, Dugan's family, who are still in Florida, are very scared. Dugan does not like to have journalists approach or speak with his family. So I'm going to be very careful to talk around this. But we did go to Florida and attempt to speak with them. And the approach kicked up a lot of anxiety. So they are certainly on edge. And for good reason. And Dugan feels very, caught between a rock and a hard place because he wants to do everything he can to protect them, but it's hard to do without leaving Russia.
Well, my reptilian brain tells me that his family being there and him being in Russia makes him very vulnerable to threats to hurt his family.
Completely. Yeah, it's certainly pressing. And as the situation heats up and as he sees kind of more indication of a pursuit by the FBI, by the MI6, I'm sure that's going to be something that he'll continue to deal with.
I mean, the thing is this, the FBI and all right. So let's talk about this for a second. The FBI has gone around, they've gathered all this evidence, they're putting this case together, they've certainly let balls drop here and there, and, they do have a history of keeping compromising material on the powerful to enhance their own power,
mm-hmm.
and, keeping those files and so on. So based on how you've seen... And you provide details if you can on how you've seen the FBI behave from the beginning of their involvement to now. What is your assessment of what's going to happen moving forward in terms of addressing this case in the courts and getting accountability?
So we are actually. Should tell you a little bit of something of how we feel about them right now. We filed a lawsuit against FBI several years ago to try to force them to release the files that they have around Epstein and around the case.
Right.
We've really pushed it to another level now that he's dead because they're supposed to just release.
Yeah. Dead men have no rights. Dead men have no rights.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're, our attorney is really confident that we're going to be able to get them, but they are doing everything they can to try to prevent us from accessing them. And it's not even just the FBI. Every single law enforcement agency that we kind of confronted during the process of reporting this was like a brick wall. Florida has some of the best laws for journalists. They have some of the best public record laws, and you're supposed to be able to get public records very easily there. And certainly I have on other cases. But when we started trying to get documents related to the case back in 2014, the Palm Beach police told me so many sob stories about how the files had been in a room that flooded or, oh, we lost a box.
Oh, God.
And then finally they said, you know what? We just gave them all to the FBI. We don't have anything. So we went on to the FBI and the story was the same. It was just total stonewalling. And, my dad was actually an FBI agent in Boston, which certainly has a reputation for being one of the more complicated agencies.
Yes. Whitey
so
Bulger.
Whitey Bulger was my neighbor. I grew up in Quincy.
Oh, wow.
So, if anyone knows about the complicated, you know, machinations of the FBI, it's certainly me. And I'm definitely experiencing a real effort from them to not aid the investigation from outside sources. And, you know, as we move forward with this case, we're all incredibly skeptical that we're going to see anything from Bill Barr's investigation, anything from the federal side. You know, as far as we're concerned, any statement about them pursuing justice in this case is really just for show. We haven't seen any indication that they want to see the truth about this come out.
Well, you want to hear something interesting? Do you know Nick Bryant? Nick Bryant, who did the...
No.
This guy is the tribe's memory on the Franklin scandal, which is, of course, the Epstein scandal is deja vu all over again with the Franklin scandal. Powerful, right. You know, blackmail operation using, you know, using young kids, boys and girls. And this was a more of a Republican, you know, targeting powerful Republicans or whatever, or servicing powerful Republicans, whatever. And I think he mentioned that Bill Barr helped tamp down helped make the cases go away in the Franklin scandal. So that's why he said nobody should have any confidence that Barr is going to move these cases forward to accountability or help these cases move into the accountability phase, because the Franklin scandal, which was huge too, and as horrific, did not go anywhere. And it was the same thing that you see now: blame the victim, and you never hear, the perpetrators never see the inside of a courtroom, or if they do, it's for it's for a hot minute. So I think your instincts are correct. And when, you know, what are you waiting for? What and where are you in the process in the courts right now?
So we're pretty far down the road, and we just did another filing right after his death, like I said, to essentially say, you know, he's dead now. What's the holdup? But
right.
I'm sure you know that any kind of legal tussle like this is so slow moving that, we're, you know, in some sense, we're doing this just as a matter of principle, because they should be held to account publicly for what's happening. But we're not waiting for the outcome of that case to, you know, try to find the truth. So, like I said, even since the book was published, even since the podcast has wrapped, we haven't stopped the level of investigation that we were doing throughout those projects. The night before the book came out, we heard from a new source close to Robert Maxwell, and since the book was released, we've been approached by so many other people connected to this case who have information, who said, oh my goodness, I can't believe that somebody's actually talking about this, that someone's talking about the espionage, talking about the Middle Eastern ties. Finally, like, you know, they feel emboldened, much in the same way that the victims were emboldened to finally tell their story, because they're not alone.
Did you read the recently released by the FBI Finders document, the 300 plus pages on the Finders child trafficking CIA-led operation, by any chance? It was about a month ago.
No, I haven't read that.
Oh, I'll send it to you. And second question, awesome. Have you listened to the collected talks online of Ted Gunderson? Because this is you have to blueprint for everything you're talking about. It's completely
it's very interesting historical context.
Up to the next minute. Sorry, go ahead.
It's very interesting historical context, especially if you're going to track the history of the FBI's behavior in this way. And it's good to look at too, because you can, you know, you. Past behavior is predictive of future behavior, and so you can maybe stay ahead of some of their machinations if you look at that file. It's very, very interesting, but it's wonderful that you have put this book out, and that because people now do realize that there's a team, which is fabulous, of reporters who are going to stay on this case no matter what, you know. So, and it does tend to draw other sources out. So I predict that you're gonna come across some amazing stuff, next level stuff, if you guys keep doing what you're doing. So what I want to talk about now, because I also think it's very important to remind people of the evil that we're talking about here. So I do want to talk about what you found out about the victims and what the victims had to say and what happened to them. Because, you know, the other criminal stuff, arms dealing and so on, I mean, in the end, it ends up killing people. But as a woman in particular, I'm just interested in your story, looking at that, what you found, what struck you and horrified you the most, how you feel about all that. You know, just talk to us about that.
Right. It's so important to not lose sight of that. And in doing the reporting specifically for these projects, I definitely did experience a deeper understanding of the horror and evil that was inflicted on these women than girls, and how it has haunted them for the rest of their lives. You know, it's easy when you're in the rush of reporting and flying through court documents to become inured to the kinds of claims that are made. But in reporting for the book and the podcast, I actually sat down and watched for the first time all of the police interviews with the victims back in Palm Beach. So these are grainy kind of surveillance videos of the interview room at the police station. And they show a detective, all the people are blurred out and pixelated, but they show a detective in one corner and then a young girl sitting on the couch. And there's, you know, at least a dozen of these. And seeing on video how small and nervous these people were, even though they were pixelated, you could see how young they were. You could hearing their voices, talking to this strange man, asking them about being raped without their parents there, without any support there, hearing the pain in their voices and the fear and the shame just over and over again for hours watching the videos, definitely left an indelible mark on me. And even more than that, as we, you know, we compiled a huge list of every positively identified victim that we'd ever heard of in the hopes of finding them and talking to them about their experiences and giving them a platform to share it publicly once and for all. And as we compiled that list and got together their contact information, you know, we're pulling public records, and there's a clear pattern going through that list of victims of really difficult lives, of drug arrests, of prostitution arrests, of evictions, of just really tragic, catastrophic life events that continued to happen to these women after their experiences with Jeffrey Epstein. So seeing the long reach of, you know, his fingers across the decades and how what he did really changes the course of the entire lives of these women was chilling. And one of the victims that we spoke to for the project, Michelle Licata, that's exactly what she said. She only went there once, and once is enough to change your entire life and change your entire perception of yourself. And she said she went there once, and she was told by a friend at high school she could make a little extra money for Christmas if she gave a rich guy a massage. So she went over there, and it started innocently enough, massaging his feet. And he, in the classic manner of predators, just kind of continued to push the boundary until she's topless and he's you know, pleasuring himself right in front of her. And she said at the time, the level of sexuality she was at was being excited about talking to a boy on the phone, you know, that it was just totally out of the realm of anything she had ever encountered. And it was over, you know, within an hour she left. That was it. She never went back. But she says that one afternoon just destroyed her, just destroyed her personally and changed her life. She later had, she later developed a drug problem, which she connects to that incident. And she came out on the other side of that and has a good life today. But she said she continues to struggle with so much, and her sense of self-worth and confidence and ability to feel like she's worthy because of one afternoon when she was 16 years old. And thinking of that kind of impact spread out across hundreds of lives around the world, and surely the lives of the people around them and their family and their children. Just talking about it, you know, gives me chills. It's really, people need to sit and think about that too, as hard as it is to confront.
I'm so glad you said that. That was the most profound assessment of, because it, in this society, we tend to look at crimes rather materially and forensically, and nobody, I'm sure you heard the woman on TV in the UK saying, oh, these girls were prostitutes. So what we do is we devalue the victims in order to keep everything rolling, you know, and
yeah, their souls are not considered. The fact that their souls are murdered is not considered. And I got to tell you that Virginia Roberts Guifre is a champion. She's a champion in my book.
Absolutely.
You know,
she's a really incredible woman.
So, Melissa, I want to know, we're almost out of time, but would you consider coming back on the show to talk about the science? Because I spent many years as a science journalist, and I'm very mystified and kind of fascinated by that, what he was up to and why.
Oh, the transhumanism angle of it was fascinating, very interesting. So, Melissa, we're out of time. Could you tell people where they can look for you and your reporting?
Yes, thank you. So I'm on Twitter at Melissa E. Cronin. That's MelissaEcronin. And the book, Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, is available pretty much anywhere you can buy books. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local store. Makes a great stocking stuffer.
Oh, it's
you are my new journalistic hero. I mean, you're just incredible.
Thank you. Well, I can't wait to keep talking with you guys.
Thanks for coming on, and we look forward to talking to you again. Meanwhile, rock on, Melissa.
Thank you. Long live the pirate.